The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. As the big transfer bay window is carefully closed and the latch placed into position, we asked, was this actually quite an interesting one? Big moves, big bids, star players with new beginnings or new old beginnings. What, if anything, does it say about the state of the game in Europe? And what sort of window have they got in Barcelona and why do they keep leaving it open? We'll discuss the players who've just arrived in the Premier League. Saul, Royal, Kral. Dan James finally gets to Leeds. Newcastle look to the movies to help them. And Saido Berahino is in League One. Also, how have the European League started? Juve lose while Jose enjoys pizza on the train. Six teams are joint top of La Liga while Wolfsburg are out in front in Germany. We'll do that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Hello, Max. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks very much. Nicky Bandini, hello.
Hi. You didn't ask how I was. I feel very, very hurt that you asked the other two how they were, and me, it's just
Nicky, I don't care. That's what it is. No, I hope you seem well, and from the chat we were having before we came on air, you appear well, but I am duty-bound now to ask you how you are.
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thanks, Max.
Oh, great. I'm glad I asked.
Are you enjoying Australia so far, Max?
Well, yes. I mean, I've not been outside yet, Lars. So, the irony of talking about a transfer window where I'm in a room where the window's only open by 2 inches was not lost on me.
Can you only communicate your future by fax at this moment?
Yeah, bureau fax is the only way I can talk. You just don't see anybody. The door knocks. You're not allowed to open the door for 30 seconds. And when you open it, there's no one there and there's a bag. And you pick up the bag and you look in and you've got chicken chow mein and you go, all right, I'll have that. And then your life continues. But, you know, at the moment, Mrs. Russian does not want to divorce me. So as you said, Barry, this is your worst nightmare that's currently happening to her.
Yeah, we have had proof of life from the current Mrs. Rushton, although she wasn't. We've heard her, but we haven't seen her. So,
sure, I'll get her on a pod before our quarantine finishes. When we're right on, the worst news is because she is flying to Melbourne, there are no flights in the evening. We have to spend an extra night here. It's like, it's exactly what you want, isn't it? We're getting out on the 8th. Oh, no, we're not. We're getting out on the 9th. Anyway, more important than any of this, look, we are not a transfer deadline hyperbole machine. But when you think about this summer, Lars, Messi, Ronaldo, Griezmann to Atleti, Grealish, the Mbappe bid, to be fair to your Jim Whites and your Fabrizio Romanos, it feels like it's been quite a good one.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by good. It's been diverting. Is that what we're going for?
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I will forever remember this as the transfer window of the big Mbappe clock in the Spanish TV studio for El Chiringuito, and the sort of dramatic Mbappe timepiece with Mbappe moving round and round. I think they have, with all due respect to El Chiringuito, I think they've reached a level of madness and chaotic sort of energy in broadcasting that have never been seen since before and will never be seen hence. But some of these sort of big moves have been exciting, but there's also been a lot of there's been an awful lot of clubs trying to move people and not being able to move them. There's been an unprecedented amount of that, which tells you still that the sort of the economic system of football hasn't righted itself just yet. We've had a lot of sagas to distract us from our daily lives. That is true.
Barry, did you catch yourself staring eagerly at the yellow ticker yesterday?
No, I hate transfer deadline day with a passion. I hate the Sky News hyperbole. I hate the way. I really feel sorry for the reporters who are forced to stand outside stadia around the country reporting on nothing. It looks quite degrading. They may well really enjoy it.
It is. People, I've done. It's not fun.
Some of them may well enjoy it, but I cannot think of much worse, to be honest. But I did wake up this morning and I looked to see what transfers had happened. And that's a really sort of time-saving way of doing these things. But I do appreciate that many people are obsessed with the whole transfer market saga, ding dong, and good luck to them. It's not for me. And I think, worryingly, quite a lot of people seem to be more interested in that than they are in actual football matches, which I find baffling. And I wonder how they're going to fill their time and amuse themselves until January.
It's interesting, you know, I mentioned Fabrizio Romano, and you know, he does stuff for The Guardian. So I remember doing a show with him where he said he preferred transfers to the actual football. And the journalist, Mariti Marunghi, tweeting last night saying, you know, what percentage of reported transfer news is just Fabrizio Romano tweeted, publish? Because, my friends, it's astonishing how he's cornered the market, resulting in a massive secondary market of Fabrizio Romano said. And he does lots of work, but what Mariti said that I really liked was said, you know, there are a few people checking his homework. Soon we'll be widely relying on his tweets as indisputable evidence that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. but I suppose, I don't know, Nikki, I don't know how you found it, or you're just glad it's done and now we can actually get on with some football.
To be honest, I think from the Italian perspective, and not that I don't survey the rest of it, it was quite a lot calmer overall than I think perhaps it felt with what was happening in England, what was happening with PSG, Real Madrid. The Ronaldo saga was this big thing that happened in a really odd way, because honestly, it seemed completely dead for a really long time because the contract just seemed unmovable. It seemed like too much, seemed like no one would do it. Then in an instant, in a heartbeat, you went from, oh, actually City are going to do it, to he's off to United, and then it was done. There's been some interesting bits and pieces towards the end of the transfer window. To me, like the most perhaps surprising twist was, I didn't think that Roma would be able to get rid of Dzeko. So when Dzeko went and Tammy Abraham came in, that was exciting. I thought that's a fun transfer that brings something different to the league. But I wouldn't say the last day had that particular sort of on-edge vibe to it that we've had some seasons. There was still some business that got done. Probably the big deal of the final day was Milan getting a deal across the line for Junior Messias. But again, we're talking about the big deal of the last day of the transfer window in Italy is Milan signing a player who 5 years ago was a part-timer delivering fridges. So it's definitely not been that sort of transfer window in Italy. And I think it's already been touched on, but, you know, football is not suddenly back to having lots of money after COVID. Most clubs in Italy are absolutely up against it, including some of the very biggest ones. Even Juventus did very restricted business this summer. There's a small pool of European clubs who are still throwing it around because they're able to. Mostly, not entirely, but mostly the clubs that have wealth that is independent of whether or not they're making profits.
You need two people to deliver a fridge. Do you think if this guy goes on to be a huge success, there'll be a guy in a bar sitting there going, when he was the top, I was the bottom of carrying those fridges up the stairs.
I didn't even really sell this fully to the full extent. Junior Messias is 30, right? So he's someone who has like a real late career development, who was playing in Serie A for the first time a year ago with Crotone. Like, he isn't someone who's got a whole future ahead of him. He's someone who's popped a bit. I don't know. I suppose it's later even than a Jamie Vardy or Ian Wright story. He's really sort of having a sort of late moment in his career, but was brilliant for Crotone last season. So is interesting, but he's not an up and comer really. And yes, who knows what we'll find out now he's at Milan. There's a bit more media scrutiny about his fridge delivering days.
Would you say that he did a lot of heavy lifting for Crotone?
Well, he couldn't lift them out of the relegation zone in the end.
Lars, can we talk about Griezmann back to Atleti and explain how that has happened and just quite how disastrous this situation at Barcelona has been and is?
Well, it's something we've touched on earlier in this pod. The financial situation at Barcelona has been dire. They've committed to paying out wages that probably weren't sustainable pre-COVID, and definitely were not sustainable after the pandemic, and it meant they had to clear house and just get people out of there and get people off the wage bill, and that meant they had to do some deals that were maybe, you know, on the surface of it maybe seem slightly mad, and sending Griezmann back to Atleti on a loan with an option to buy for not that much, it's for 40 million euros. Which again, bearing in mind they signed him for what, 120 million just a couple of years ago, is disappointing for them. But that is the situation they've ended ended up in. It's really horrendous management, aided by some bad luck of the pandemic happening just at a time where the club was not in a good place. I think what you have to say is that of the people sort of departing Barcelona, I don't think Griezmann will be the biggest miss here, because ever since they signed him, he's looked like someone who hasn't really fit into the team, and he's a very good player, but he's never looked like a natural fit at Barcelona. And if you're looking at outgoings at Barcelona, I think someone like Ilaix Moriba leaving for RB Leipzig, partially because they weren't able to sign a new contract with them, but also partially because they were happy to raise some money for him with the situation being what it was. And that sort of transfer, I think, is kind of more damaging to the club moving forward, because he was a young, very, very promising player that you were thinking maybe will be part of this team going forward. But instead, you know, they've had to throw out a lot of bathwater, and there's certainly a distinctly baby-shaped item in that bathwater. And actually, I don't think Griezmann is the biggest loss there.
And Lars Saul left Atleti to go to Chelsea, which sort of opened up the door for Griezmann to go to Atleti. What have Chelsea got there?
They've got a very good midfielder who has a good range of passing, technically very sound. But someone who also has the sort of the graft you expect for someone who's played in midfield for Diego Simeone for many years. I think he complements what the options that Chelsea have in midfield very well. He has played left midfield and left back on some occasions as well, so I think he could be an emergency solution at left wing back if that's needed. He's someone who will challenge either one of Jorginho and Kante for a spot in that central midfield, and you know, he might not immediately dislodge either one of them, but it's a long season and a lot of football to be played, so I think he'll be very useful to them.
Quite interesting that Saul's last contribution in an Atleti shirt was an assist for their equaliser against Villarreal on at the weekend, where he sort of lumped a hopeful diagonal crossfield ball forward, and it was promptly headed into, or Assi Mandi promptly headed it past his own keeper into his own net to give Atleti a sort of very late lifeline.
It was brilliant, wasn't it? Because it was almost, the reaction of the Villarreal players was almost like sort of Sami Kafur's against Man United, or you know, the Ajax team against Spurs, just sort of like Unai Emery like beating the floor going, I cannot believe that has gone in. West Ham have had a good window. Have they? I don't know. I mean, who knows how good Nikola Vlasic is these days? And I confess to knowing nothing about Alex Kral, although I hope at some point he plays alongside Tim Krul.
He does look a lot like David Luiz. He's like an Eastern European David Luiz, which I think is very positive. And I also like that their scouting policy at this point is just asking who's on Tomas Suchek's WhatsApp. Like, have you got the number of some of these guys from the national team? They seem quite handy at the Euros. Like, what can you sort us out there?
Moyes, you can't fault his recruitment policy when it comes to Czech players. So if Kral is even half as good as the other two lads he's brought in, he'll be okay.
Kurt Zouma as well, they've got. Spurs have got Emerson Royale, as in Royale with cheese, which Paul Hawksby was saying. Some people happy with Royale, some people wanted Royale with cheese. Heard him saying on TalkSport the other day. A right back who spent the past two seasons at Betis. Matt says, will Sajourier be stripped of his knighthood, or does he retain privileges while looking for a club? He's left Tottenham, terminated his contract. It sounds so brutal having your contract terminated, doesn't it? Just the word terminated feels slightly more fatal than just leaving a football club. Sajourier said, I've really enjoyed my time at Spurs. I'd like to thank the club and the fans. I feel now is the right time for me to move on to a new challenge, he said. Dan James to Leeds, Barry.
Yeah, it's a great signing for them, I think, as well. He's a very young, enthusiastic and quick. Obviously has a fan in Marcelo Bielsa, and it will be interesting to see how his career develops. It didn't look like he had much of a future at Manchester United, and so it's come to pass. And obviously we saw 2 years ago where he had all but signed for Leeds. He posed with the shirt, done all done everything basically except actually sign the contract. And Swansea, I think in the Swansea boardroom, they just stopped taking Leeds' calls because the higher ups at Swansea were sort of bickering among themselves over whether to sell James or not. And in the end, they didn't. So I don't think there'll be any animosity between, you know, Leeds fans will welcome him with open arms. They see it as a great result. I don't think Manchester United fans will be too upset to see him go. So I think it's a really good move for him and not necessarily a step down, more of a step sideways.
Damien says, has Tomiyasu to Arsenal surprised Nicky at all?
I wouldn't say it surprised me. He was linked for a little while, actually, to Arsenal and Tottenham, both of them. He's someone who is 22. He's at Bologna. He's had a couple of good seasons. Clubs like Bologna, when they get a player in, and after a couple of seasons, they're getting attention from the Premier League. This is the sort of club that's going to sell. So it doesn't surprise me hugely. I think he's an interesting player. He's someone who very tall, but actually I'm not quite sure where he best fits, whether he's best as a centre-back or a full-back. At Bologna, he played more at centre-back, but then seemed more comfortable when he moved to full-back, although he did pretty okay at centre-back as well. Certainly, I think before that, he'd played mostly in a back three. Interesting player. In Italy, they refer to utility players as jolly. So he was a jolly in Italy, someone who could, as I say, fill different roles. And I'll be interested to see exactly where he fits in what Arteta is planning. But 22 years old and one of those defenders who I think is certainly very good at bringing the ball out of defence and playing progressive passes. That was something that really got talked about a lot during his time at Bologna, is how he was helping the team build from the back. So something to build on, but I don't know if I can say yet, having sort of seen a couple of seasons of him at Bologna, whether he's going to be a really great player or if he's just someone who was doing pretty well on a team with pretty low ambitions the last few seasons at Bologna.
With your Arsenal hat on, how have you found the window and the start of the season, or do you just not want to think about it?
I don't know how to explain it to people, really, because I think people will think, oh, you must be so upset, they're doing awfully. And I think I reached a point with Arsenal of apathy a little while ago, where it's just so hard to emotionally invest yourself in a club where the ownership are not emotionally invested in the slightest. I think it's really hard to stay sort of with a mindset of this matters, when it's so obvious that the people in charge of the club don't really care about the results on the pitch. And that's how I felt about it for a little while. And yes, the results have been dreadful, but it's not like it's come out of nowhere, is it?
Crystal Palace, as we mentioned on Monday, have got odds on Edouard from Celtic. Also slightly surprised Ryan Christie's gone to Bournemouth from Celtic. I thought he was good enough for the Premier League. The best player in the world, Salomon Rondon, has signed for Everton. And Newcastle, as Johnny Liu pointed out, have just recreated the plot of Goal. They've signed a young Mexican forward called Santiago Munoz. And the character in Goal was called Santiago Munez. 17-year-old will go into the academy squad. This is Luke Edwards from The Telegraph writing. Very much a Steve Nixon signing. Nick says, as Newcastle's scouting seems to extend to watching Goal, the dream begins. What other characters from football movies can we expect to see signed before the window closes? Robert Hatch from Escape to Victory's goalkeeping cover. The girl from Gregory's Girl, he says.
I would suggest Arsenal maybe could do with the dog from Soccer Dog the Movie. 1999's Soccer Dog the Movie. Maybe he can change their fortunes.
Have you seen Soccer Dog, Lars?
I've merely seen a trailer and it looks spectacular.
I didn't realise there were two, because isn't there also, because there was a whole Air Bud franchise which started with one of basketball or American football, but I'm certain it got to football as well at some point. So I don't know if those two movies were up against each other in the box office or if they were just different eras of footballing dog.
Maybe on the, you know, the fifth wave or whatever, whenever there's football all stops again, we can do a watch along of Soccer Dog and talk the listeners.
That is actually a good idea.
Is it? Well, it's something to do, isn't it? Mark Cucurella, Getafe to Brighton, 15 million. Who is he, Lars?
He's a sort of former Barcelona Academy graduate who can play as a sort of quite attack-minded left back, or he's been playing left midfield for Getafe because they're quite defensively set up. He looks good. He looks sort of to the extent that anyone looks adventurous playing for Getafe, but you know, he's quite sort of active and lively on that left-hand side there. Someone who should really slot in at left wing back for Graham Potter, and I'm expecting him to do very well. I think possibly a bit of a coup for Brighton. He's someone I imagined would go to a bigger club, with all due respect to the Seagulls.
Of all the transfers that happened in the Football League, I think Saido Berahino to Sheffield Wednesday, sort of the one that just sort of popped out at me, at least, sort of scanning down at all these what looked like made-up names from Championship Manager, if I'm being honest. Richard Jolly's stat, Saido Berahino has missed all five penalties he's taken since Ronnie Corbett died. it's quite a statistic. It's interesting.
I thought you said at the start, Max, that he was gone to Ligue 1. But it was Ligue 1.
Yeah, it's not Ligue 1. It's Ligue 1. Absolutely.
Because I was really intrigued. I was going, where is he? Who's he signed for? Because I wasn't sure where he had been. And I was sort of intrigued to hear he'd signed for a top-flight French club. But no, it's Sheffield Wednesday. So,
do we think that's ever happened to a footballer, that they've been sort of confused by their agent into thinking they're going to one of those two leagues and showed up in the other one? A bit like, you know, you hear these stories, probably apocryphal, about people wanting to fly to London but winding up in London or Ontario. Do you think there's ever been a footballer who's really thought they were going somewhere and just woke up in the wrong place?
Well, if Max was my agent, I'd think I was signing for Montpellier and end up at MK Dons.
Stefan Mbia, the French midfielder / defender Stefan Mbia, did one of those amazing interviews with L'Équipe in an international break where he spoke way too freely back in the day when he was at QPR. And one of the things he said, and maybe he was joking and this just hasn't translated well, but he definitely said that he thought he was heading to the Scottish club Rangers, not Queen's Park Rangers, which might have been a surprise to him.
Berahino was at Zulte Sportvereniging Zulte Waregem, which is a Belgian first division side. He had some time at Charleroi as well. Anyway, let's hope he can turn it around at Hillsborough and score lots of goals. Sheffield FC, who I think are the first ever football team, sure what level they're in the pyramid, but just tweeted, to any of our supporters staying up late on transfer deadline day, we're skint, go to bed, which I thought was quite a nice tweet. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll ask Nicky all about Serie A. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Thomas says, what's the link again to financially support the pod? Barry, would you like to make another impassioned plea, or do you think we did enough begging on Monday?
I don't think our overlords approve of us using the B word.
Oh, right.
I think it's, and I don't think it is. We're offering plenty in return. So
I completely agree.
If you would like to make a donation to the party coffers, please feel free to do so. And obviously, if you can't afford it or you're skint like Sheffield FC, just wait till more fruitful times to make your donation. You're welcome to continue listening for free. But if you have got spare money and you don't give it to us, then you're just a tightwad.
Yeah, well, it was established a couple of years ago that Football Weekly had the most loyal audience and the tightest. And But actually, when we said it, it was a call to arms and you did deliver. And then I think you gave more money than anyone else. The website is support.theguardian.com/contribute. support.theguardian.com/contribute. Serie A, Nicky, Juve lost Ronaldo and then lost to Empoli. How did that go down?
Yeah, and it would be really easy to connect those dots, right? Look, Ronaldo's gone and now Ronaldo isn't there and they're losing games, but they had games exactly like this last season. They lost to Benevento last season at home with Ronaldo present. So this is not something that was sort of alien and didn't happen when Ronaldo was there. This club has been... I don't know. It's like been like a listing ship for a little while. They've been taking on water. They have been lacking any clear direction for too long. And it's been really ever since Max Allegri left, and perhaps even before that, perhaps even the signing of Ronaldo is the sort of ultimate example of their loss of direction. And that's not, I think it's really easy to confuse these things and for people to hear what I'm saying, because people are very passionate about Ronaldo, as they are about Leo Messi and certain other superstars, and to think it's him being blamed when it isn't. What I think did happen with Juventus, though, is they said, I think really from a leadership standpoint, from Andrea Agnelli, the club's president, downwards, they said, we've reached this point where we're winning all the time in Italy, and we've gone to two Champions League finals, but we feel like we can't progress anymore. We've maxed out our commercial revenues within the current environment that we have, where other Serie A clubs aren't keeping up in their investments and building new stadiums and becoming what we want this league to be. How can we become something else? And it was sign Ronaldo and become something else, which from a marketing standpoint they did. And I think this is the thing that people, when you just talk about the football, miss. You know, Ronaldo really did transform their things like their social media following, but dramatically shifted their social media following. And I know that's boring. I know people want to roll their eyes and go, oh, do we care about Instagram? We care about football. But for your commercial opportunities, for your ability to make bigger deals with sponsors, for your ability to get certain sponsors into the room, those things are really significant. So in all of those ways, that was what they were doing when they signed Ronaldo, was making that step. But they also did have the footballing goal, which was stated very explicitly when they signed Ronaldo, of we're going to try to win the Champions League. And I think where all of this fell down was there was no actual accompanying move to make sure that the team around Ronaldo fit Ronaldo and was really designed to win the Champions League. And I think over the last couple of seasons in particular, there's been areas of the pitch that have not been properly addressed. And I know some people, I've seen even reactions to column I've written, think that it's mad to say they haven't got a good enough midfield, because they've brought in players, right? They've brought in Rabiot, they've brought in Ramsey, they've got Arthur in from Barcelona. It's not like no money has been spent there, but it's all been so chaotic. It's felt like Ronaldo aside, and then De Ligt was this other big statement signing. Look, we can go and get a young player who all of Europe wants, who probably they didn't need yet. I understand wanting him because Chiellini and Bonucci are getting older, and I think he's going to still be a very good player there, but perhaps wasn't the biggest need. Other areas of the pitch have just been neglected. They haven't properly sorted out the fullback position. Alexandro has gone from being someone who was really promising at the start of his career to really drifting in the middle part of his career. But the middle part of the pitch in particular has been totally incoherent, and especially since Miralem Pjanic left. And so now, after two seasons in which you've gone from, well, I guess 3 years, you go from Allegri to Maurizio Sarri, who is this very odd appointment who never seemed to fit Juventus, but was, in theory, going to bring attacking football. You then go to Andrea Pirlo, who's a manager who's going to bring through the younger generation on the basis that, what, he's younger and he's used to talking to younger people, even though he's not, you know, actually a young footballer age.
He's on the TikTok.
Right. You've gone through these two steps. And you haven't kept the squad developing in any real clear direction. You've brought in some really good players. I mean, they've signed in that time Kulusevski, who I really like, although he didn't have a great first season at Juventus. They signed Bernardeschi, who was supposed to be a really sort of special footballer, but hasn't really panned out there. And they've signed Chiesa, who really does look like he's going to be brilliant. Again, certain parts of the pitch, like midfield, you look at it and go, doesn't work. There's no one in that midfield since Pjanic left who's going to play the reducer role. And now Allegri is back, you can see he wants to fix that. You can see Allegri in a way that neither Sarri or Pirlo perhaps felt confident. Allegri thinks, I'm in charge. This is my project. You've told me to get lost after winning the league over and over and over again. And now I'm back and we're going to do things my way. And I think his way, his perspective was, Ronaldo, he can stay or go. It's 1 year. But all of his press conferences, all of the way he talked about the team was very much, Ronaldo is not the cake, he's the cherry on top, right? If he's here, he's a valore aggiunto, he's an added value. So Ronaldo goes, that's fine. We're not worried about that. But I think what hasn't really happened is that while Allegri is perhaps, in some ways, Ronaldo leaving even reestablishes Allegri's power. There's no other power base at Juventus now. It is Allegri's team. But he hasn't actually got what he really wanted in this transfer window, which is again, it could literally have been Pjanic. They were talking about Pjanic. A midfielder who they trust to be a regista, to hold the ball in the centre of the park. They've signed Manuel Locatelli, who I think will end up doing that. And I really, really like Locatelli. I personally think last 2 years at Sassuolo and at Italy, you see his best role is a bit more hybrid, right? He can play box to box, but I think he will end up in the short term holding down that middle position. But he's just signed and he doesn't start the Empoli game. So against Empoli, you have Danilo ends up playing in central midfield as the sort of holding midfielder, looks completely lost. And then Weston McKennie, who is someone who I think has probably been, there's some things I really like in his game, but has been a bit overhyped because he's American, because America, when as soon as an American player does anything in Europe, there's this sort of momentum of excitement that builds up around a player, and ends up playing at number 10. Neither of those two players look like they are at all comfortable in those positions.
Nicky, can I ask about Weston McKennie? He got hooked at halftime on against Empoli, wasn't playing well. Over the course of the window, he was linked with Spurs, Villa, Everton, and quite weirdly Burnley, but he hasn't gone anywhere. Pirlo questioned his attitude or his lifestyle issues, shall we say, suggested he wasn't as professional as he perhaps should be last season, and he was caught breaking lockdown regulations by staging a party in his flat. Missed at least one game over that. Is he a wrong'un, or does he have a future at Juve? Does Max Allegri rate him? Do you know?
I'm not going to call him a wrong'un. I think that's jumping some big steps from being a young guy who's living abroad, who probably has felt, I imagine, desperately lonely at times the last year and made some mistakes in terms of breaking lockdown rules. I think the media went overboard with him about how good he is, and he may become very, very good. But to me, as a footballer, he's really, I want to sort of fall on an American term, actually, and call him a sandlot player. Like, he's someone who you think in a chaotic game, when things go to pieces, he has a lot of personality. He's very aggressive. He's very combative. And I think in scrappy games, you see him take over situations. And that's really sort of where he thrives. I don't think I've seen enough from him myself as someone who has subtlety to his game and who has the ability to really fit in a specific role in a system yet. And I'm not sure, even after all this time, what his best position is within a midfield. And certainly he did not look even remotely comfortable as the number 10 for Juventus this weekend. So I don't think he's a lost cause at all. That's not what I want to say. I just think that people got really a bunch of steps too far ahead of themselves with him because of a few good early performances. And I'm not sold with him yet.
Andy says, as a Roma fan and massive Mourinho skeptic, am I getting sucked into his dark magic, or can I start to feel excited about our start? Yeah, there was a lovely, you know, that when he's happy and winning, you know, and he's eating a pizza and drinking a Coca-Cola on a train, you know, even, and I know, like, I've been burnt. I'm starting to think, oh, it's all going to be all right.
Well, I mean, free-throwing Roma. I saw the highlights of their win at the weekend, and it really does not seem in keeping with their manager's general philosophy. And
give him time.
It can
give
only be a matter of time before he breaks them.
Also, they were, before Nicky says it, they were playing Salernitana, who are pretty terrible, I think, based on what I've seen. And also, he hasn't had a chance to break their spirits yet. I mean, give them a few defeats when he has to blame someone that's not him, and see how many players end up under the nearest bus, and then see how happy everyone is after.
Yeah, well, the Salernitana point is sort of doubly worth making, because actually Roma last season under Fonseca, their issue was they could not beat teams in, I think it was not even the top six, the top eight of the league. They had some really like emphatic wins over lower teams, but they just could not beat anyone even in the sort of top conversation for European places. They couldn't get those results. So they've got a lot to prove still. I do have this sort of early, I feel like there are some early warning signs that this Serie A season could end up being a
goodie.
Not about Mourinho. I was going to say about the league.
Oh, okay.
Could end up being very split between the sort of the haves and the have-nots. Some of the lower teams do look quite out of their depth at the moment. But I agree with you, Max. I'm having to fight myself from getting swept up in it, because fun Mourinho is fun. And the football team certainly...
He's doing it again. That is amazing.
The football team certainly has been fun. And Tammy Abraham, because I know people have asked about him as well, has been for two games, and it is only two games, but he's looked brilliant. He's strong. I mean, everyone knows these things about him. He's strong. He's tall, and he's really bullied defenders at times. But I think if you see, he scored his opening goal for Rome against Salernitana. Even better than that for me was his involvement in the one-touch move that led up to Roma's opening goal. He's just doing his job as a number nine perfectly, as sort of the target man who can just sort of be the pivot sometimes, as well as being the player who gets in behind the defence. I think that one signing, in a summer when Roma made some other signings, Roma had already been quite active. They bought in Rui Patricio, they bought in Vigna. I think it's just really transformative in terms of very specifically who Roma are. And I talked about it, I think, already on the podcast, so I don't need to completely rehash it. But Edin Dzeko is just such a different kind of striker. Edin Dzeko is very much the pivot, but he's not someone who is also going to play on the shoulder defence. He's not someone who at this age has got that energy level that I think Abraham brings. And I'm excited. I'm really excited to see how that all shakes out for Roma.
I was just going to ask Nicky, while we're in Italy, I mean, I feel like it's been dominated by outgoings more than incomings this league this summer. But is there one sort of transfer to Italy or one transfer within Italy that excites you that you would like to talk about?
I mean, Abraham is the big one, certainly sort of financially in terms of someone coming in. And I think also probably is the one who I'm most excited about as an individual player. I think probably in terms of others, Locatelli. Obviously, Locatelli's a really sort of thrilling player who's had his moment for the Italian national team, and I want to see him now go to a big club and to kick on. I think in some ways the things that most excite me for this Serie A season are not so much the new signings. There's one player who moved already last year who has had a promising start, who I really want to see if he can kick on and become... again, something that all of Italy thought he was going to, which is Sandro Tonali at Milan. I think he was someone who arrived there as all this hype as we get every few years, the next Andrea Pirlo. And last season was really disappointing, but beginning of this season has started brightly and scored a lovely goal at the weekend. I think more than players, though, what I'm sort of... Actually, Joaquin Correa, I think, going to Inter is really interesting as well, because Correa lived a bit in Immobile's shadow at Lazio, but of course everyone thought, oh, will Immobile follow Inzaghi to Inter, and now Correa is at Inter and doing well. The other sort of thing that I really wanted to focus on with Italy is the managers. I think Maurizio Sarri at Lazio is such an irresistible story if it works. I don't know if it will, but again, early results, very encouraging. Scored 6 goals at the weekend. I think Luciano Spalletti being back in Serie A and at Napoli, who I think have this dark horse squad who can be competitive, is exciting. Mourinho is obviously exciting. I think there's a lot of intrigue for me in that. And I think, you know, it's a cliche in Italy. It was Conte's story. It was what Marotta said about Conte when he came to Inter. He's our real top player. But I do think those managerial changes and how they shake up the top four are going to be really a big part of this season.
We had a question from Adam saying, I'd love to know a little more from Nicky about Pordenone, who have a water park outside the ground. I've just tweeted out a picture of it. It looks absolutely brilliant. It looks like you could stand at the top and watch the game. And when there's a throw-in or like someone's injured, you could just shoot down the slide and get back to the top.
So Pordenone are a team who have spent most of their time in lower leagues. And when they got promoted to Serie B in, I think, 2019, they were in this position of having a stadium. They're from a town of 50,000 people where they had a stadium, home stadium, that was not adequate, didn't live up to the Serie A regulations. So they've actually bounced between a couple of venues since. But since last season, they have been playing in, I just need to remind myself the name of the stadium. They've been playing in the Stadio Guido Tecchi.
Centre Parks, they've been playing in Centre Parks, no, haven't they?
Stadio Guido Teghil, which is in Lignano Sabbiadoro, which is a coastal town nearby. It's about like a 30-mile trip from Pordenone. And this stadium doesn't have like a natural home team. So it's kind of just a communal local stadium in a seaside town and happens to have a water park next door. Now, of course, don't forget that last season, Max, stadiums were closed, and especially we're talking about the Serie B stadium here. So last season, there were no fans inside the stadium, but sometimes there were fans standing on top of the water slide watching a football game.
I feel like this is, there could be some inspiration here for, I mean, Jonathan Wilson referred to United, certainly in the paper, becoming this sort of nostalgia theme park rather than a football club. But if behind Old Trafford, the main stand, could be a big roller coaster with sort of twists and turns that are somehow, you know, designed to mimic the 1998 and 1999 season, I think that would be very good.
I seem to remember there was I think it might have been at Hotel Football or at the club, there was a Sir Alex Ferguson burger. And I did speculate about whether it was cooked with a hairdryer and whether that would be the grimmest thing, the grimmest way you could cook a burger. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we forgot to talk about Kylian Mbappe, so we'll do that at the start of part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Real Madrid tried to buy Kylian Mbappe. PSG reportedly turned down an offer of 190 million euros. Patrick says, can someone explain why PSG would turn down all that money from Mbappe when he can leave for free next summer? Barry, can you explain it?
Well, they don't need the money. So there's that for a start. That's not, you know, it's a lot of money to me or you or Nicky or Lars, but it's not a lot of money to them. And they're, I think, still hopeful that he will sign a new deal. I suspect they're barking up the wrong tree there. He has apparently turned down a 45 million euro a year, 2-year contract extension. And the thing about Kylian Mbappe is he seems to be a very single-minded young man with a very specific career plan. And the next step of that career plan is to go to Real Madrid. So it's win-win for him, really, because he's obviously being very handsomely remunerated. He gets to play a season with Leo Messi. And then at the end of the season, he can move to Real Madrid on a free, get a massive signing on fee, get a heftier wages. So I think that's the reason he hasn't gone. PSG just didn't want to sell him, and they hope he will stay, but I don't think he will.
Lars, do you think it was a kind of bluff by Real Madrid? They were offering all this money, a bit like, you know, someone at an auction, a charity auction, going, I don't want Carl Fogarty's leathers, but I want the charity's leathers. So I'll offer £1,000 and then nobody else bids, and you're like, oh shit, now I've actually got to pay for it. I mean, I don't understand where they've got the money to bid this.
So this was suggested. Well, where they got the money is pretty simple, because they haven't really made any signings for the last couple of years, and they've let people go and raised money that way. So you can understand, in spite of sort of Florentino Perez's ludicrous assertions that the whole industry is going under, back when the Super League was trying to happen, they were trying to make that happen. I mean, they do have some money, and that's fair enough. What you're suggesting is not just, it sounds fanciful, but I mean, that's what PSG sporting director Leonardo suggested publicly that he thought was going on, that this was just a ploy. The way it's been explained by people who know Real Madrid better than me is that this was a kind of a power move, that this was Real Madrid wanting to show, you know, we're still the big dogs here. You know, the PSG don't get to have Mbappe and Messi and Neymar, you know, that sort of holy trident. We're gonna break that up before it's even started. We're gonna throw some weight around. You know, we're still relevant. We're still the big dogs. That was almost like a flex, like the sort of idiots who sort of burn cash on the internet to show how rich and successful they are. It was kind of the equivalent of that. I guess that is a logic. I still think it's incredibly stupid, and I think as a club they'll be a lot better off with this thing not happening. And then they can sign him for no transfer fee. Of course, some of the money will have to go to his sign-on bonus, I guess, because that's kind of how free transfers work. But they'll still be, from the leftovers, they can still sign, you know, can put that towards signing Paul Pogba on a free transfer and maybe getting Alan Haaland in as well if you want that. And there's so much you can do with that money if you want to rebuild this team as a serious force. And I do feel that PSG have kind of saved them from themselves here. But also, I mean, without going full Wilson here, I will put it to you that maybe Mbappe leaving now might not have been the worst thing for PSG, because that front three, I still don't understand how that's meant to work with Mbappe, Neymar, and Messi. You're in a situation where, like, Neymar is the hard grafter of the bunch in terms of work off the ball. I mean,
he's,
you know,
the Heskey,
and,
right? Again, he's the Heskey in that three.
It's not rational team building at all. And I actually think if they'd have taken the 200 million euros or whatever it was and reinvested it into a forward who does a bit of running, the sum total of that team might have made more sense. Now, it's not going to matter in Ligue 1 when they're sort of putting 8 goals past Nîmes and teams like this on a regular whatever. But when it comes to winning the Champions League, which is what they're all about, I think having a more balanced team would have maybe been good for them. It's like, you know, well, again, one, I mean, supergroups notoriously shit, but also, like, we can put it in detective terms, as we're prone to do on this podcast. Like, you need, Sherlock needs a Watson. And in this case, you have a detective group where you have sort of, you have Sherlock, you know, sort of and Poirot and Inspector Morse trying to solve it together. And there's just no sort of hardworking but slightly gormless sidekick to help them in the right direction. And I think a group of those three wouldn't achieve anything. I think they'd just squabble over methodology and just not figure anything out. Like, they need, like, someone needs to be Watson, someone needs to be Lewis, there needs to be a Captain Hastings involved here. And I actually think they would have been better off.
I just on the detective team, I have watched the first episode of the new series of Vera, and I have to say, it's much more enjoyable watching it when you know that her number two thinks Jonathan Wilson is a twat. for anyone who doesn't know, by the way, he's a Manchester United fan, Kenny Doughty, the actor, and he got very, very, very agitated on Twitter about an article Wilson wrote about, Wilson famously hates Manchester United, and a less than reverential article Wilson wrote about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Can we, Lars, can you quickly tell listeners who don't know about Eduardo Camavinga and then move on to round up if anything interesting has happened in La Liga in the opening games?
Yeah, so Eduardo Camavinga is an unbelievably talented midfielder who sort of came on the scene back in 2019, which is just a weird thing to say because he's still 18 years old. I mean, he was just 16 when he made his debut, and he was just 16 when he sort of became a regular in Ligue 1 and just looked for all the world like someone who was, you know, should already be playing in central midfield in a very big team. Now, it hasn't been all completely smooth since there, and he's still a little bit raw, and the step up to Real Madrid is huge, but he's someone who's looked just like he's going to be one of the best central midfielders in Europe, and that he is going to end up at a club like Real Madrid eventually. Maybe some sort of middle step from Rennes to Real Madrid would have done him well. He's going to be thrown into an environment where it's difficult for young players to succeed at Real Madrid. It just is. He's suddenly have to compete with, you know, Luka Modric for minutes. It's not easy, but incredibly, incredibly promising player.
And in terms of how the season started, you've got 6 teams at the top, all on 7 points, so nobody with a 100% record.
Everyone's dropped a point somewhere. I think it's interesting to see Valencia starting the season quite well under Bordalas, the former Getafe manager who's gone to Valencia, and they got a 3-0 win against Alaves at the weekend. Can he sort of scrap them? I don't want to belabor this, the sort of, because it is a slightly flawed. I mean, he isn't fully the sort of Spanish Sean Dyche. I mean, such a thing couldn't really exist, I don't think. But he is the sort of coach who, you know, turned Getafe into this really well-organized, really niggly, the sort of the kings of the yellow card and the shithousing. You know, seeing a manager like that go to kind of like a big-name club where there's a lot of expectations, even if the club is a bit of a basket case, that's something that really intrigues me, like, following how is this going to go? But no, we have a situation now where Real Madrid, Valencia, Sevilla, Barcelona, and Atleti all have the same number of points after 3 games. So, you know, can't really conclude anything one way or the other, I don't think.
Briefly in Germany, Wolfsburg 3-3.
Yeah, which is unexpected. Wolfsburg, who you know, I hand on heart, I thought it was going to be one of those classic sort of mid-table team sneaks into the Champions League. You know, the coach leaves. Yeah, going to fall back again. But Mark van Bommel has gotten it going for Wolfsburg, which is something I think we all want to see. Mark van Bommel in the big time, merrily two-footing assistant referees all over the place would be very good.
So I did a lot of work with Mark van Bommel over the summer.
Did you?
And, which was the end of the Champions League. Yeah, well, I did a series of sort of online corporate.
This sounds made up.
No, totally. No, I did them with Luis Garcia, Mark van Bommel, and who was the third one? Oh, Berbatov. Yeah. But van Bommel was just a delightfully nice bloke. Yeah. And, you know, obviously, like, it's weird doing a corporate when they're in their house because they're sort of like eating their dinner or like telling their kids to leave the room. But yeah, he was a very friendly man. So I've bought into the van Bommel Wolfsburg cause. I'm invested. That's the word that I couldn't remember.
In terms of what was interesting at the weekend, it just feels so long ago because of all the transfer stuff. But in this latest round of fixtures, I guess the real points of interest was that Dortmund, and again, that was on the Friday, so it feels a very long time ago, that Dortmund did beat Hoffenheim in the end, because I think it was really important in terms of just the mood going into the break and everyone hoping Dortmund will keep up with Bayern this season. They almost dropped points away to Hoffenheim, which would be completely unforgivable, but very, very typical for Dortmund, the sort of nonsense that they do way too often. But then in the end, Erling Haaland turned up, as he always does, or very often does anyway, for them, and thwacked the ball into the net, as he is prone to do. And I would also, just as a very, very minor thing, see if you can find online the goals from Augsburg versus Leverkusen, 1-4 to Leverkusen away to Augsburg, just because. I say this again, the Bundesliga is a tremendously fun league to watch, but part of the reason is that some of the defending that goes on in this division is unbelievable. And here we had a game where there were 5 goals, in which I feel like 4 out of 5 was some level of completely disastrous work by the defenders involved. 2 own goals. The game kicked off with 2 own goals in the first 15 minutes, and it didn't get a lot better in terms of the defending. It was quite something. God bless the Bundesliga, I say.
An interesting take, actually, from the Borussia Dortmund game was that the 3 goal scorers, Jude Bellingham, Gio Reyna, and Erling Haaland, all born in England, and have a combined age of, shudder, 57.
Oh, I thought that was at least it's older than me. You know, that's, yeah. I was thinking.
But it's less than 10 years older than me. But, Lars, I wanted to ask, or anyone who might want to venture an opinion on it, Bayern Munich has signed Marcel Sabitzer from RB Leipzig for a song, which means now they've taken him, Deo Upamecano, and the manager, Julian Nagelsmann, from RB Leipzig in the last 6 months or so. How depressed should we be by this, or is it just business as usual?
It is business as usual. So Sabitzer is an annoyingly good signing, I think, for Bayern, because he's a good player, obviously, and he's like in the prime of his career, and he will weaken a direct rival, but also because he's really versatile. You can play him on both flanks, you can play him as an attacking midfielder, as a defensive midfielder, and when I was looking at Bayern, I was thinking, like, the only thing that can go wrong for them, really, is if they have a disastrous injury, if they have some injuries, because the squad isn't really that deep. Well, here you've added a really good player who can cover in a bunch of different positions, who is like in the prime of his career, and is like, for God's sake, like it's a very, very smart signing by them. And there is an added value to not just signing good players, but signing them from your direct rivals. If you can do it, it's very, very handy.
2 final bits of admin. One is clearly the best transfer is Juan Ibiza, who is signed for Ibiza. We can't be disappointed with that, can we? He's a centre-back, and he came from... doesn't matter, does it? He was born in Ibiza. He's called Juan Ibiza, and although his full name is Juan Fernandez Blanco, but for whatever reason, he's known as Juan Ibiza, and he plays for Ibiza. And
is he good at playing the ball along the decks?
Almost. Oh, very good. In other music news, we were discussing Men at Work, and my boss over here has said that Colin Hay from Men at Work is a big football fan. So perhaps at some point before this adventure is over, he will come on with you, Barry, and you can do Down Under together.
Oh my god!
I mean, why not? Eh? Or when we do the live shows in Australia.
I was about to say that is save it for the live show,
absolutely,
guys.
Absolutely right. That,
people will pay money for
that's
this.
That's how we fill the Opera House, isn't it?
Exactly.
Here we go.
Right.
Do 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 do. Oh, hang on, I'll get sued for doing that, won't I?
So we'll get sued. We'll get sued.
Anyway, that'll do for today's pods. We're back on Friday because we're doing it after the England game. I only told you that an hour ago, Barry, so I hope you can make it. But in the meantime, thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks, Max.
Back on Friday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.